Welcome to Unseated Airwaves. My name is Danny. I am Otopemsoit Nehio from Treaty 6 area. I was born and raised in Sealth Territory with cultural guidance from the Osoyoos Indian Band, and I use she, her pronouns.
And I'm Olivia. I am Métis from Alberta, and I use she, they pronouns.
I'm Audrey. I'm Tsimshian. I was born and raised on Vancouver Island and moved here a couple years ago to come to UBC, and I use she, her pronouns.
Hello. My name is Cooper. I grew up on Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam lands called North Vancouver. Do you guys know who Vancouver is? I don't. Okay, sorry. I use she, her pronouns. And did I say my name's Cooper? My name is Cooper. Thank you. Bye.
This is Unseated Airwaves, hosted by the Indigenous Collective since 2015. I am the Indigenous Collective lead, and everyone here volunteers. We are here at so-called UBC in the unceded territory of the Hunkminum-speaking Musqueam people, who are the Musqueam First Nation today, and the historical shared territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations in the city that has been colonially labeled as Vancouver.
Today's episode is called Whimsical White Man Anthropology.
Okay. What is anthropology to you, and what are some of your experiences with anthropology?
Well, first of all, I am an anthropology major. I would have majored in archaeology if that was a choice, but alas, anthropology. I think so far, it's been very colonial, if I'm being honest. Like, I don't know. Quickly, without spoiling the episode, I'll say, like, people are good at, like, being subtly excusing of white men. And I think that's really, really what I experience anthropology as.
Yeah, I don't have a ton of knowledge of anthropology. I have taken a couple classes that discuss it before. I think, similar to Olivia, a lot of it has been very colonial, not really focused on Indigenous perspectives. I did have the privilege of taking a course last year with Dr. Charles Menzies here at UBC, and that was really great. But yeah, I honestly, outside of my time of UBC, I don't have a great deal of knowledge about it.
Yeah, I'm majoring currently in sociology, anthropology, before I get into the School of Social Work, hopefully. And I was also in that class with Dr. Menzies. And I think I've taken a few classes, like anthropology classes and sociology classes taught by Indigenous profs. And it's a completely different experience. But I did take Wade Davis's Anth 100. And Wade Davis is, like, oh my God, he is, like, probably the most famous anthropologist right now. And we have a lot to say about this guy. Cooper, what? Because I know you were not familiar with anthropology before.
I wasn't, but I took notes.
Yeah. What did you kind of think of? Because I think when I described it to you, I was like, Egyptomania, like that, like, cultural whimsy. What were your kind of thoughts?
Okay, whenever I try to figure out something, what something is, I, like, break down the word. So, anthropology. Ology is giving the study of. Mm-hmm. Anth, anybody?
The funniest part.
Not me. I don't really know.
I should know this.
It's all good. You're good.
Man or human?
Okay, interesting. But it's kind of giving, like, the study of culture,
yeah.
Different cultures, yeah. But it's weird that Google gave you man first.
Yeah, the study of humans and culture. I feel like for a lot of people, and, like, what my kind of thoughts of anthropology were, is definitely that, like, I don't know, Indiana Jones, white man, like, salvage anthropology. I think of Egyptomania and, like, all of those anthropologists there. And I was in Wade Davis's class, and he is applauded by a lot of people. And we were just talking earlier about how in order for, like, a man anthropologist to get awarded and, like, everyone be like, oh, he's actually really good, he just has to, like, not be a eugenicist.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't know. Like, I agree with you on, like, Indigenous anthropology is, like, so different. I took a class last year with shout out to my professor, Professor Barnett. Don't get mad at me. It's fine. Shout out. Who I'm taking a Go Global seminar with, and she's like very like a decolonial slay, like, oh, if slay. Even like if you're studying Indigenous, you should say Indigenous centered if you're white. And if you're Indigenous, then say you study Indigenous anthropology. And she's just like basically breaking down all these like colonial uses of anthropology. Because I think, in my opinion, a lot of anthropology is just like mostly white men saying wild things, wild unhinged things that they don't understand completely. Mm. Yeah.
Exactly that. Wade Davis really framed the class as, like, we're going to study a different culture each week. And he would do these lecture recordings, which were not, like, of the actual lecture itself. He would, like, do, and it must have been, like, he, you know, does the same thing for Anth 100 every year. So he already had these recorded. But I think it's really telling that in these recordings, he would have props everywhere. He would have artifacts, memorabilia, everything for every culture we explored. So everything he taught, he lived with those people for weeks, years, and he just had this complete whimsy about it. And I think the, like, capitalist idea of, like, these objects representing culture in this very exploitative way, and the way he framed it, it's kind of like what we'll get into with George Catlin and his paintings of Indigenous people. It's kind of giving that.
It's raining, I'm staring outside my window. There's a tiredness in my bones. I feel helpless and alone. Deep within our mother's womb lie the bodies of children in unmarked hidden doom. And reason, that's what they say that you'll get when you have kids. And I did. Bruises and fresh open wounds reveal stories that were told to me in room. I knew an old man who'd sit in his armchair. Sometimes at night I'd catch him crying, sitting there. He cried because when he was a kid, he spoke his own language and then lost his voice and part of his own lineage. This land is your land, this land is my land, this land was made for you and me, a poor choice of words by Woody Guthrie, this land was taken, and now everyone sees, one family had their land stolen, the other was stolen from their land. Static noise transmission on the radio. There's an aching in my bones. I feel lost and far from home. Purpose and reason, that's what they say that you'll get when you have kids. And I did. I'm not sad.
stayed underneath all that pain. Heartbeat of cold rain. I know a black woman who sits at a desk chair. Sometimes she cries sitting there because fear became her worst nightmare. She cries because her only son was killed by a shotgun. Another senseless tragedy triggered by police brutality. This land is your land. This land is my land. This land was made for you and me. A poor choice of words by Woody Guthrie. This land was taken and built on slavery. One family had their land stolen. The other was stolen from their
is your mom obsessed with Vicks Vapor Rub?
So is ours!
Are you too obsessed with Vicks Vapor Rub?
So are we!
Tune in to Viva Porú, el ungüento para el alma, here at CITR 101.9 FM.
A radio show dedicated to Latin awesomeness and culture. Hosted by yours truly, the one and only
DJ Bruja, and the other one and only
DJ D-Rod.
Disclaimer, Viva Perú, el momento para el alma, contains a high amount of llama content.
DJ D-Rod and DJ Bruja are not responsible for a newly found llama obsession.
Catch us every other Sunday at 5 p.m. Besitos.
It's Nardwuar, a human serviette, and you're listening to Unseated Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM.
We have been called the Indians.
Justified in opening fire that day. Amy Allen has more.
The virus took on many shapes. The bear, the elk, the antelope.
Welcome back to our whimsical white man anthropology episode. This February, we are playing only Afro-Indigenous artists here on Unceded Airwaves. You just heard Stolen Lands by Julian Taylor off of his record Beyond the Reservoir. Julian Taylor is Black Canadian and Mohawk. His mother's family is from Kahnawake. I saw him at the Chan Center in 2022 come toward the fire at UBC, and it was an amazing performance, a beautiful show. So we're going to read some parts from this article, Wade Davis and Imperfect Anthropology by Marion Loheed. And she's kind of a Wade Davis apologist in like what I just said. He's so great because he's not a eugenicist and he's not super racist. But we'll read some parts of this article because I think it really captures the point of like the place of privilege that he comes from. Born in Quebec in 1953 and raised in the suburbs in a loving home by dutiful parents, he had watched his banker father go to the office every morning and return each evening for a cocktail and dinner. I desperately wanted an interesting life, the alternative I had known, he reflected years later.
On a whim, he chose to major in anthropology, hoping this might set him on course to an adventurous life. Instead, he found himself bogged in the tenets of ethnography, the formal study of people and their cultures. The field seemed so slippery and obscure, at least as it manifested in rarefied Cambridge.
Then he attended a lecture by ethnobotanist Richard Evans Schultz, and fell into the thrall of the, quote, swashbuckling scientist, as Schultz would be eulogized by the New York Times. Schultz had spent years up the Amazon, collecting more than 24,000 plants and emerging as the leading authority on hallucinogen and medicinal species. His field offered solid, graspable scientific concepts and adventure and drugs. Davis was sold.
This all really captures that he just had this upbringing that was so privileged, and I feel like we see a lot of this in like kind of alternative scenes of like these rich people who grew up with these very normal, loving parents, suburbs lives, and they're like, I want some adventure. Let me go exploit some people. I just looked up Wade Davis, Indiana Jones, and there's so many articles calling him Canada's Indiana Jones. And this is an article talking about Wade Davis's incredible home office and overhead library. And this is just the introduction. Wade Davis is a modern day Indiana Jones. He has one of the most coveted jobs in America, explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. What does that exactly mean? His profession is a cross between professor, world traveler, anthropologist, ethnobotanist, photographer, and writer. And I think we really need to look at this dynamic of him being an explorer as a, like, to these cultures that have existed for thousands of years. For him, it feels so white supremacist, this idea of like, still, even though we're addressing all these aspects of colonialism, he's still just like a white man raised in white society that has like been the detriment of these communities for so many years, being like, I'm gonna explore.
Yeah, I don't know, it's very icky, and like, this is kind of a side rant, but I feel like I was telling all these beautiful people that when I'm on campus, I know, and this is absolutely true, don't at me, when there is a male anthropologist on campus, he will be wearing an Indiana Jones-esque hat. And sometimes a satchel. And I think the side rant is just that, like, men can just get away with being so uninteresting and unoriginal, especially Wade Davis, who is very privileged, and the, quote, explorer is just so colonial that he doesn't realize.
Like, what does it mean to explore? Like, where you're coming from and where you're going, like...
And the fact that they have a literal costume as well just makes it so perfect.
Literally.
In 1983, Wade Davis embarked on an ethnographic and toxicological expedition to Haiti in order to study two cases of zombification that had been confirmed by authorities. Interesting there that it's been confirmed by authorities once again, colonial, what's it called? Like, colonial binaries of power and just, like, structures of power at play there. And while he believed that he had uncovered the exact chemical compound used to create a state of zombification, the samples he sent to be tested did not, in fact, yield any results. On a theoretical level, Davis's argument was sound. He witnessed pufferfish being used in nearly every instance, and pufferfish poisoning was extremely similar to the effects of the zombie compound. The debate continues today. And Wade Davis, even though it didn't really yield any results, I remember being tested. It was either the midterm or the final. It was a multiple choice question of like, which compound was it? And like, he made up the name for it. and I think I got it wrong. I didn't even remember. And then another thing we were tested on that has been proven to be wrong and is literally just his exploitative white man explorer philosophy is the Inuit poop knife.
God. It's just, it's so weird that this man keeps getting jobs because I don't understand what he's good at. Like, I don't say that to actually be mean. Like, I don't know. What I understand with the poop knife is that it doesn't even exist. Like, it's not even a real thing. It's just something that this man said, yeah, this happened. Totally. I don't know. Like, the fact he's been proven wrong so many times is, like, kind of icky to me. Yeah. Okay, this is from ZME Science. According to legend, a family in the 1940s or 50s, depending on the version, wanted to abandon the rough, nomadic lifestyle of the Inuits, but the grandfather wanted to stay. He refused to come along, clinging to his traditions. To push him to leave, the family took away all his tools, but instead, the man stepped outside, defecated, waited for his poop to freeze, and then fashioned it into a frozen blade, sharpening it with a spray of his saliva. This is where it gets even darker. And if you want to be spared the gruesome details, you may want to skip this paragraph. Using his poop-fashioned blade, the man killed a dog, used its rib cage to fashion a sled, and its hide to conceal another dog, and then just sled away on his ghastly construction, never to be seen again. The story was popularized by anthropologist Wade Davis in his book Shadows in the Sun, based on an encounter with an Inuit named Oleak Narkitavik. Someone can totally...
Narkitavik, I'm thinking.
Narkitavik, okay. Narkitavik claimed that the story is well known, but it's not clear if the story was meant to be true and literal or if it was more of a folktale meant to showcase how Inuits can deal with adversity.
And first, this article is using all of this terminology completely wrong and is not naming any nations. And even in telling the story, Inuits, it is not a word. It's an Inuk singular, Inuit plural, and even then that is such a broad term and we should be much more nation specific. I really, really don't like how they talked about it in that article, even just, which is criticizing the story. But yeah, I was literally tested on that and I was like, I had to like, yeah, make sure that I had the story right in his class, and I feel like you could tell the TAs were kind of annoyed. So, let's go to, why is anthropology usually colonial?
Okay, well, anthropology, this is usually colonial, at least to me. Like, I feel like in terms of, like, university and institution especially, it's often, like, it's getting better now, definitely. But a lot of anthropology has been, like, seen communities and people as subjects or studies rather than actual people. And I think to an extent that still is, like, in classes they'll talk about it better and be like, oh, this indigenous community, but then they'll just like generalize everything, which is really weird. Also, like, etic approaches, which means that you study a group outside and don't talk to them, you just like look at them and watch, which is very strange. And I guess like a lot of colonial anthropology is viewed where culture is like different than Euro ideas. Like, culture in colonial anthropology is like, okay, like what other cultures exist rather than like, oh, we should learn about their culture.
How are you gonna study a culture without talking to the people Sorry, but I'm like, what?
No, it's really confusing.
Yeah, and if an anthropologist like Wade Davis does an approach where he lives and tries to assimilate with the culture, he's awarded because it's like, oh, wow, you see them as human beings.
Bruh, doing the bare minimum out here.
Literally.
Mm-hmm. And then institutionalizing anthropology and trying to decolonize anthropology within institutions. Can institutions that educate in the field of anthropology be decolonial?
I think my short answer to this is yes and no. I don't know how to expand on that more, but one of the examples was I was in class and like we were looking at a lot of examples in the past, and like that's fine and I get why we are, but a lot of the anthropology classes I take don't discuss like current issues. Like, I'm sure there's a class for that, but like I'd love to see like, you know, like more including of like the indigenous land we're on and like actual modern day examples instead of like, oh, this happened, and like just broadly going over examples.
We gotta talk about Dr. Girl Boss.
We do. I mean, she's low-key girl boss. Like, I don't know your opinion on her, but I loved her because she was, like, anti-Wade Davis and, like, this was terrible. And I don't know, like, I haven't found any, like, articles on this, but she literally told us that Wade Davis, like, dug up graves in Haiti, which I have to research that more. People can correct me, but I'm pretty sure that's a thing. Like, she told us that, so, I mean, girl boss, like, I don't know if that actually exists.
That is not girl bossing. It's like, wait, what's the three of them?
Gaslight?
It's more like gatekeeping, I feel like.
Gatekeeping.
I don't know. What are you doing digging up graves?
Yeah, he definitely did dig up graves. Unknown the sheer amount. I love your wallpaper of the galaxies. Thank you. Absolutely love space. And also, so Dr. Kate Kingsbury was our prof for Anthropology of Zombies, Witches, and Vampires. And the chat basically kind of became an Instagram group chat. And, you know, saying things like, the church is so anti-girls having fun, like, to that extent. And someone called her, like, Dr. Girl Boss, and she just, she really went with it. And she really is Dr. Girl Boss. She was a pretty good prof. Charles Menzies, I mean, he does just yap about fish, but let the man be co-sailors. I was reading his review, his Rate My Profs things, and it goes back to, like, the 2010s of people being like, all this guy talks about is fishing, fish, the coast. Can he be a co-sailish man? This is like me yapping about buffalo. Like, let him enjoy his fish.
I come from the same band as Dr. Menzies, and I can confirm that all my relatives also love yapping about fish, so don't worry. It's like, a common thing.
Let them yap. Yeah, he's a really awkward guy, but he's really fun, and I recommend his classes. He gets really sassy with, like, his decolonialness, which I love. Dr. Kate Kingsbury also brings that to the table. I love this, like, just sassiness with UBC. Yeah. I wanted to read this quote that was from the article White Supremacy and the Making of Anthropology. One second. By Aisha M. Beliso de Jesus, I don't know, Jemima Pierre, and Junaid Rana. So I'll highlight the part that I'll read. And this article is really talking about, and really getting into the nitty gritty of, like, what we're talking about here today. And I really think you guys should hear this. So, it is in this context that the four-field tradition of U.S. anthropology emerged out of an uneasy alliance between U.S. nationalist sentiments in the 19th century and evolutionist approaches to human difference. The attachment to a four-field approach in anthropology obscured the settler colonial process and evolutionist desires hidden within the discipline itself. Morton's Crania Americana and Crania Aegyptica, for example, deployed scientific data on brain capacity, presumably to demonstrate that both African and Native Americans who filled an intermediate position were inferior to whites.
The structure of white supremacy depends on understanding the nature of settler colonialism, which justified dispossession and elimination by, quote, rendering the native as non-human, uncivilized, and unsuited for civilization, and thus inevitably ceding to the white liberal progress by disappearing. That's from Speed 2020, page 77. From the late 1890s, the liberal focus on, quote, salvage ethnography added to the further racialization and intoxication of Native Americans. Conceived of as living specimens or living objects, indigenous communities' skeletal remains, crania, and ancestors were removed from burial grounds and displayed in museums. While it is easy to imagine this history in the past, this treatment of indigenous people is still an uncomfortable modern reality in the discipline, as many departments still hold the remains of indigenous people.
And just a few days ago, law was already passed a few years ago, but they had to add some things to it because it was pretty gray area. Nobody was following it, and it was Secretary of the Interior, first indigenous person to hold that position in the United States, Deb Haaland. And she put out this, she updated it and added a provision that all indigenous, like, objects in any museum, especially mortuary or funeral, like, literally remains, it needs to be taken away from public view and have an immediate investigation into whether or not they have consent to display that object. And that has led to the Museum of Natural History, like the one from Night at the Museum, literally putting blankets over their exhibits and, you know, locking everything up, these halls, to reevaluate. And I read, never read the comments on a National Post article. never. There was literally one, like, they all had the same sentiment of, oh, they're doing this to review anything, like, incorrect histories and it was like offensive depictions of indigenous ways of existence. And all the comments were like, oh, what? So they can't tell it like it was? They need to clean up the barbarianism and can't show the real truth? And another one said, no written language, no wheel. And, like, was basically saying, like, basically savages running around. And just the no wheel really got me. Like, no wheel, genocide warranted. No wheel. No wheel, no existence deserved. And in that quote, the four pillars of anthropology that were mentioned are cultural or social anthropology, linguistic anthropology, biological or physical anthropology, and archaeology, by the way. And then another really good quote from that same article, anthropologists critiquing the United States as a racial state show how white supremacy is extended through shifting power dynamics grounded in liberal notions of race, nation, and difference. Indigenous anthropologist Circe Stern calls for anthropologists to critically theorize white supremacy in relation to sovereignty and settler colonialism, rather than focus on questions of racial authenticity, offering abolition as a vehicle to address carceral reproduction and the compromised possibilities for Black women. Black anthropologist and doula Donna Ayne Davis provokes a rethinking of the role of white supremacy in the afterlife of U.S. slavery. I'm going to just say her first name because I don't want to get mixed up, like the Davises. Donna argues that for Black women's bodies, reproduction and population control are structured by white supremacy and intersect with Black maternal life and death in the United States. Writing from the position of being unapologetically Black as a critique of white supremacy, Sean Jay claims Blackness as a positive value to disrupt Black respectability politics, which are themselves grounded in whiteness. And this article, again, it's called White Supremacy and the Making of Anthropology, is a really good critique from POC themselves. And I just really think it should be put in our hands. Anthropology seems to be all right when it's, I don't know, indigenous operated. And even Dr. Menzies, who we were talking about, he doesn't really like being an anthropologist. Like, what he teaches isn't really anthropology. And I feel like what we're talking about as anthropology is dying, and I'm glad.
Ya sé que me gusta a mí, como no me va a gustar que me suban hasta el cielo, que me vuelvan a bajar. Ya sé que me gusta a mí, como no me va a gustar que me suban hasta el cielo, que me vuelvan a bajar.
MRG Live is happy to present Anomaly with his live band at the Wise Hall on Saturday, February 24th, with support from Blue Wednesday. Anomaly has toured his electro jazz project all over the world, but this February, the Montreal-based artist embarks on a full Canadian tour for the very first time. Come out to experience the innovative fusion of electronic beats, jazz harmonies, and funky grooves from the one and only Anomaly, live in concert with his band. Don't miss Anomaly at the Wise Hall in Vancouver on February 24th, 2024. Tickets are on sale now at admitone.com.
In the context of Vancouver's opioid crisis, CITR would like to take a moment to share some harm reduction strategies.
Try not to do drugs alone. When going out, let friends know what drugs you're taking and make sure someone has a naloxone kit. If you're able to, Get your drugs tested before taking them.
Avoid mixing opioids with alcohol or stimulants. Remember that opioids can include painkillers prescribed by a doctor, and it's possible for any drugs to be contaminated with opioids.
Learn the signs of opioid overdose, which include, but are not limited to, unresponsiveness or unconsciousness, inability to speak, breathing that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, heartbeat that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, skin tone that has turned blue or gray, choking or gurgling sounds.
If you think someone is overdosing, call 911 immediately. Start rescue breathing and administer naloxone if you have it. You cannot get in trouble for being on drugs, so always call 911 in an emergency.
For more information about naloxone kits and training, visit towardtheheart.com.
Thank you and stay safe.
It's Nardwuar, a human serviette, and you're listening to Unseated Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM.
We have been called the Indians.
Justified in opening fire that day. Amy Allen has more.
The virus took on many shapes. The bear, the elk, the antelope.
Welcome back to our whimsical white man anthropology episode. You just heard ASO by Joaquin Cornejo and Gotopo off of the EP Las Frutas. This February, we are playing only Afro-Indigenous artists on Unseated Airwaves. Gotopo is an Afro-Indigenous Venezuelan producer, composer, and musician. Here's what Latina.com had to say about her. Gotopo pays tribute to her Afro-Indigenous roots while reinventing folkloric sounds. The singer-songwriter has cemented her mark as an artist, establishing a unique fusion between folkloric instrumentation and electronic dance music. Joaquin Cornejo, who is also on that track, is an Ecuadorian producer and DJ based in Quito. I think it's also important to mention the field of archaeology and that role within all of this, and the act of, like, the exploitative act of Mother Nature of literally digging into the earth for stories and for evidence of things. And
yeah, and even, like, there's something also called, like, there's also, like, archaeologists for, like, companies and, like, definitely, like, a lot of oil companies, too. And I will say even that is kind of iffy because it's, like, if you are digging something up, like, it should be indigenous-led and communicated. And I think a lot of the times, like, what I learned from our intro to archaeology is that a lot of the times these, like, companies can just, like, put up posters saying they're digging, and that's what they call community engagement, and then they just go dig, which is really iffy and icky, and I think that's also very colonial and very exploitative of communities.
I can't find it now that I'm searching, but I follow them on Instagram, and there's this group in, I believe, Ontario, and it's Ojibwe archaeologists, and it is all Ojibwe operated and Ojibwe facilitated. And it's this team of archaeologists working to uncover pieces of pottery to retrace past histories of cooking, food, and art. And it's it's a completely indigenous team, and I think they're really cool, and I follow them on Instagram. And I love when they give a little update that they found a new cool piece of pottery, and I think it's really awesome. And, like, when I was in elementary school, I remember they brought, like, all the indigenous kids, like, into, like, the gym, and it was kind of, it wasn't, like, an assembly, like, being spoken to, it was kind of, like, in groups almost, and then they had, like, these volunteers from the museum, like, in my town, and I think from the cultural center as well, and they had these, like, artifacts of, like, arrowheads and tools, and I was really young, so I barely remember it, but I remember them, like, letting all of us hold it and pass it around and, like, talk about it and talk about its use. And I guess that's kind of indigenous archaeology in practice. I mean, it was still, like, a weird experience, and I, like, don't remember too much, but they did want us to have that, like, because those objects, I guess, were just sitting somewhere, and they wanted randomly, I guess, to just let us look through them, feel them, learn about them. And it was so cool to actually hold it in my hands. And that's what I remember the most, like feeling the arrowhead, thinking about like how they would have carved each and every little like notch in it. And when I was a kid, that made me feel really proud and cool. I don't know. So we're going to talk about George Catlin a little bit. And it says that he was a lawyer, painter, author, and traveler, but he really was a salvage anthropologist, if anything. And he specialized in making portraits of indigenous people from southeast to northwest, literally everywhere. He like went from Cherokee territory to Coast Salish territory. He was everywhere. And he went during the 1830s. He wrote about and painted people all across, and he did a lot, and he spent most of his time in the plains, which is where my nation is from. His paintings are very famous and widely used as like, this is what pre-colonial life was like, even though smallpox had already devastated a lot of our communities and our culture had already rapidly changed from the trade industry and capitalism being imposed on us even at that point in time. And we can read this quote from an article called George Catlin and the White Gaze by Phoenix Hassler, which kind of brings into more perspective why his paintings might not be as accurate as they are proclaimed to be.
One large issue to note when looking at Catlin's work is that he was always trying to make a profit while creating his pieces. Catlin was trying to create a record of Native nations, but primarily was trying to make money. Not only did Catlin profit from the exploitation of these subjects, but also of indigenous prisoners. He was able to gain access to dying indigenous prisoners and capitalize from these works, such as his portrait of a Creek man named Osceola. It is works such as these that really show Catlin's agenda and desire to profit from his portraits.
And this is from Art Review, Playing Tricks with Reality and Realism, which shows that there was already this salvage anthropology desire to look into what the past was, what we really were like. And here's a quote from that. Art Review, I don't know if I already said it, but Art Review, Playing Tricks with Reality and Realism by Holland Cotter. When public interest proved only so-so, he took the operation to London, Brussels, and Paris, where he had success. Crowds came, titled patrons ordered copies of his work, Baudelaire gave him a rave review. Catlin tried to sustain the interest, but his efforts backfired. He was accused of exploiting the indigenous people and creating falsified depictions of their lives. I didn't know that. Very interesting that there was criticism even at that time, so it must have been really bad. Debt-ridden, he asked the United States government to buy the paintings as historical documents, but he got no reply. So he finally sold them to a Philadelphia factory owner whose widow donated them to the Smithsonian in 1879. And I bring all of this up to point out how capitalism inherently incentivizes exploitation, really. Like, that's what we're talking, like, getting at here. It's just exploitation that lies at the hands of colonialism and capitalism. And I know we throw around the term late stage capitalism a lot, but I think we really need to consider that we've been in this for a while. Like, it didn't just with industrialization like magically become a million times worse. It was already seeping into everything, like at the time of colonization. So I guess I kind of want to briefly mention, like, just growing up, like, you know, I'm mixed, so there is whiteness. There is so much whiteness in my life. And growing up, I definitely was a part of Egyptomania. And as a kid, so many of us were like National Geographic, Ancient Egypt, and the pyramids. And, what are these called?
The hieroglyphics,
the tombs, Tutankhamun. Egyptian, like ancient Egypt mythology, and then completely ignoring contemporary history of Egypt and Egypt, people living in Egypt and the exploitation of Egyptian history and culture. And even still today, it kind of goes unquestioned and is like a joke on Twitter. Like, remember when we were kids all obsessed with ancient Egypt? And I feel like for a lot of us, that was our introduction to anthropology and, like, anthropology and colonialism making its way into our lives.
As a field, yeah. Hey, guys. It's me, Cooper. what's going on?
Did you ever read books like this as a kid?
Definitely. I definitely remember seeing those in elementary school.
I feel like there was a lot of, like, so-called Greek mythology as well. Yeah. Like, that obsession and a lot of stuff misrepresented.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's a lot of random, like, Greek and Egypt lore that I got as a child in elementary school that probably is not accurate at
mm-hmm.
all.
And it was such a phenomenon. It was such a, like, ancient Egypt gods and goddesses and just, it's so whack. And ignoring contemporary history and not teaching anything about that to the point where I feel like a lot of people were like, had a moment like, Egypt still exists?
Yeah, bruh. I have a hard time wrapping my head around why certain things get popular over other things.
Yeah, definitely. And it's like how in Iran, Iran has one of the oldest and largest bazaars. And out in that area in Iran, it should be like an eighth wonder of the world. It's these ruins, and it goes on for so long, and there's all of these ancient mosques, and I think it really shows this anthropologist, colonialist, exploitative idea of, like, Stonehenge, the pyramids, and a complete ignoring so many cultures that are stigmatized and racialized. And I feel like Islamophobia is so big in that, in this, like, I remember, even though Islam is extremely old religion, I remember only really learning about Christianity and, like, the history of that, even though Islam is, like, the largest religion in the world, I believe. And, like, so many countries have history with Islam, and I never learned any of that because it was just so stigmatized and it was so put into one box of, that's what this is, and yeah, we don't really care, even though, like, Iran is home to basically the oldest civilization in the world. Like,
yeah, for real. And there's so many Iranian people here, and they're always so nice.
Yeah,
they're,
and, like, so nice. People don't know about, like, oh my god, I see all these comments on things that are like, I can't believe this is Canada today, and not understanding the, like, history of Punjabi Sikh people and, like, that religion and the stigmatization of that, and also Baha'i. And that's why there's many Iranians in Canada, is because their religion, Baha'i, is extremely stigmatized, same with Sikhism. And people are so ignorant.
Yeah, they did history weird over here. They present it like it's fact. Like, I remember reading the book Educated. I don't know if you guys know that book. Fuck, what was it? But pretty much I read that book and kind of had the realization that, like, history is written by someone. And it's weird to me that was a realization I had later on in my life.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, shouldn't I have known that from the start, that history is stories
mm-hmm.
told by people?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. That one freaked me out a bit. I was like, what?
Yeah. That's like when I was a kid being raised Christian, and I remember really thinking about the Bible, and when I really thought about, like, this was just written by some humans. Like,
yeah.
This was human imperfection, and yet it was, my family was so literalist with the Bible, and so interesting. And I think this, so much of this is the repercussions of anthropology as a field, and this whole idea of putting culture in these boxes and then coming from the outsider assumed whiteness perspective, like Wade Davis being an explorer. Like, what does that mean to explore?
Yeah.
Like, that is totally putting whiteness on a pedestal, and everything else is below it for the white man to go and explore.
No, for real, their words are so loaded, and they act like they have no target. They're like, we didn't think this out, we're just some men
exploring.
But, like, to use a word like that for someone who genuinely came into these communities and, like, caused a large amount of harm because they wanted to study them, it's really, like, an inappropriate use of language, in my opinion.
I agree. And just to backtrack and add on to the Egypt thing, in my house, like, I love my dad so much. He didn't believe this, but you know, like, that ancient Egypt show, like, alien shit?
Absolutely.
Yeah, my dad would just put that on and, like, be like, oh, this is awful. Like, this is so weird. But, like, what did what was so I took as so racist from that show is how the guy was like, how did they build the pyramids? Was it people or aliens?
No, and for
I was
real.
Like, no. I was like, no, it's so racist that you cannot fathom a person smart enough to do this. No. Like, oh my God.
Yeah, they're so weird in the West. They're so weird about old civilizations too. Like the concept of cavemen and the way they come across in animations as like these really just like airheaded people. Yeah. It's like they what? Like they're just people.
And
peopling.
One of the things that Wade Davis is applauded for, like, is because he's like, oh, we don't like exactly what we're saying right now about like the just idea of modernity and that we are so much smarter than our ancestors, and it's like, no, our human brain has had the same like capabilities, and he's so praised for that. It's like, wow, he's an anthropologist and he thinks, and he's not a eugenicist, and he thinks, well, that I mean that falls into not being a eugenicist, and it's like, you're not that special, you're just whimsical white man that is somewhat critical, a little
it's
bit.
So all of it is so whimsical white man. Because like, what are you?
Yeah, I love our episode title because it's just
explorers.
Whimsical white man anthropology. And with that, that is today's episode of Unseated Airwaves. Before we go, I want to say that we stand in indigenous solidarity with the people of Palestine, and ooh, Israel is committing genocide.
Yeah, we
currently as the Super Bowl is happening,
no
there
one cares
are
about the sorry, maybe Danny cares about the Super Bowl, but
I do not.
Okay, no one cares about the Super Bowl. Keep
well,
going,
it's like Israel is intentionally carpet bombing currently, bruh, because the Super Bowl is happening and no one is paying attention.
Oh, that's so
yeah.
As much as I
hate Twitter, the good thing about that platform is like it's showing so much like people's thoughts and you're seeing so much of it.
Yeah, I'm glad so many people are still talking about it.
Yeah, Rafa, I'm not sure, it's RAFAH is where they're currently targeting. They sent flyers out through mail a few days ago telling people to evacuate, and they can't really evacuate. It was a completely BS plan, and I believe some of the instructions were written in English. That's how performative it was. It's meant for us to see it and be like, wow, look, see?
They're putting on like a weird show, like it's a movie. Like these are people's lives and their homes. And
do not listen to
everything.
Propaganda.
Yeah. No,
if you,
really
oh my God,
up.
Literally when I see up. Israel versus Hamas war, I'm like, shut up.
Oh my God, it makes me so mad to have to start from that description. It's like, why are we talking to each other? Like, go read a book before we.
Yeah, no, I'm going to start saying it's Palestine versus IDF war.
For real.
Yeah. If you're listening to Unseated Airwaves, you are not welcome here if you are a supporter of the IDF. Or, as some of us call it, the IOF, the Israel Occupation Forces.
Yeah, For real.
For real,
Palestine or nothing. Come here because you love Palestine and Palestine only. Thank you.
Turtle Island to Palestine. Yay. Occupation is a crime.
From the river to the sea, baby.
Thank you for listening to Unseated Airwaves today. Bye.
Wait, can I threaten them?
Yeah.
Tune in. Do it. Tune in. Do it or else. Or else I will find you. Tune in.